I'd like to remind you that for more Microsoft Webcasts, you can go to Microsoft.com/webcasts. And thanks again for joining us for today's MSDN Geek Speak webcast, Mastering the Dynamic Keyword in C# with Bill Wagner. And it's now my pleasure to turn the floor over to our first presenter, Glenn Gordon. Glenn, you now have the floor.
Thanks very much, and welcome to everybody who's joining us live for another episode of MSDN Geek Speak. As mentioned, my name is Glenn Gordon, and I'm a developer evangelist with Microsoft based in the Atlanta area. And my co-host on today's Geek Speak is Jennifer Marsman. Jennifer, how's it going?
I'm doing pretty well, Glenn. How about yourself?
Good, good. I think we just did another one of these a few weeks ago.
We sure did. Thanks for having me back.
Fantastic. We'll keep bringing the great guests, and we can always have fun on a Geek Speak.
Absolutely.
So Jennifer and I are developer evangelists. We spend a lot of time working with the local developer communities, and oftentimes we'll run into gurus, people who are into technology at an amazing level. And the Geek Speak webcast series is an opportunity for us to bring those folks on the line for an hour and sort of pick their brain and share with us their experiences in the various technologies they're experts in, and also give the live attendees an opportunity to ask questions to dig a little deeper into the knowledge. So Jennifer, what's happening up in your neck of the woods in the Detroit area?
You know, I have been traveling so much, Glenn, that I'm not altogether sure. We do have another Give Camp. We've had a series of Give Camps coming up. So the Ann Arbor Give Camp will be coming up in July. So mm-hmm. We're all excited about that. There's also Give Camps going on in Columbus and Cleveland. So a whole storm of them coming in July. Pretty excited about that. And then last week I was out in Redmond, and I got to work with the Visual Studio product team talking about their early thoughts for Dev 11.
So wow. Already? It's time for Dev 11 already.
I know. They got to start planning.
Yeah.
Comes out
yeah.
the door.
Yep, that's so. Cool. So any features that come out in it that I don't like, I'll blame you.
Okay.
Excellent. Yeah, we've got some Give Camps ready to go down here in Georgia. We've got some planning stages for the Atlanta one, and there's one coming up in Augusta in August, which is interesting. And a couple of them all up and down the East Coast as well. GiveCamp.org is a great resource for that.
Yes, GiveCamp.org will point you to all the Give Camps around the U.S.
Yep. So our guest today is Bill Wagner. And Jennifer, I guess you know Bill through the community up there, right?
I do. Bill Wagner has just been an amazing resource. So Bill is a C# MVP, so I've worked with him very closely in that capacity, in addition to being a regional director. So Bill is the regional director for Michigan, and regional director is kind of a funny title, but it's a special honor given to a select few. I think there's only a couple hundred worldwide.
Right.
And these are people that have just done some exemplary work with Microsoft and have very wide-reaching scope.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, Bill's been very active in the Ann Arbor .NET user group. It's actually hosted in the building of his company that he co-founded with Diane Marsh, a company called SRT Solutions, and they just celebrated their 10-year anniversary. Congratulations on that, Bill. So 10 years, the company that he started way back in the day, it just turned 10 years old. So that was kind of a very exciting moment, I'm sure, for him, and I can let him talk a little bit more about that. And then the final thing probably to mention about Bill is that he's the author of two fabulous books, Effective C# and More Effective C#. And the thing that's really cool about these books is that they're in Effective C#, it's 50 specific ways to improve your C#. So he walks through little tips and tricks. So it's formatted as a series of tips and tricks of how to improve your work with the C# language. And then each of those little tips and tricks gives you, you know, a couple pages on how to work with that with code samples and such. So it's an amazing, really easy way to learn C# and to kind of get advance your level from beginner to a more advanced user of C#. So, Bill, why don't you tell us a little bit more about us in your own words? That's my kind of here's all of the great things I think of when I think of Bill. What did I forget?
Well, I don't think you forgot anything, Jennifer. Thank you very much for the glowing introduction. I started doing a lot of C# development as the language came out, with the 99 or 2000 PDC, and started working with it then.
Mm-hmm.
Jennifer said, wrote Effective C# and More Effective C#, and then now there's the second edition of Effective C#, which is an update including a lot of the C# 4.0 items to work with that newer release of the language. As Jennifer mentioned, the company we started here is exactly 10 years old now, so we had a little shindig that we're still sort of cleaning up after last night. So that was a lot of fun. And that's really about the main part. Other than that, we can just start get started on the topic and kind of dive into some of the changes in C-sharp 4 and working with the dynamic keyword and dynamic programming in C-sharp.
Excellent.
Sure. That sounds great. So just to remind folks, we'd like to keep the Geek Speak interactive, so please use that question and answer pane and type in some questions around C-sharp and specifically, I guess, around our focus area today, which is the dynamic keyword. So Bill, do you want to give us maybe the evolution of where the dynamic keyword, how it came about and what the thinking was about why we would need this, these sort of capabilities in the C-sharp language?
Okay. Well, now, C-sharp clearly is and will remain a statically typed language by and large.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are a lot of advantages to using static typing, but as we look more and more, there's different languages or different environments that we want to interface with as C-sharp developers. Things like Iron Ruby or Iron Python or the Office APIs or COM objects in general, where dynamic programming or dynamic typing is a much more concise way to solve certain problems. And in fact, we can treat C-sharp objects as though they were dynamic.
Interesting.
And get some of the same benefits there. So there are times when we want to move away from this static typing and give ourselves a little bit more freedom to do some dynamic programming because it's a lot more concise way to solve problems, and then roll back into static typing. So the way the language team did that is they added one keyword, which is dynamic, and that tells the C-sharp compiler basically that whatever variable this is, treat it like system.object, but it may have any number of other capabilities that we'll discover at runtime. And that's basically the language support. And then from the other side, the combination of the DLR team and the base class library team added some APIs and some interfaces and a base class that enable you to create an object that can behave dynamically at runtime. So we can create C-sharp types that actually gain new properties or gain new methods at runtime based on other items that you give it.
Okay.
Very good.
So does that sort of change the way a developer is going to look at a particular problem? Because now that they have this capability, there may have been hoops that they had to jump through before or stuff that they couldn't even really designed for, and now they can sort of address that by using the dynamic keyword.
I think so.
They got to be careful that you're not advocating that everything become a dynamic object, right?
Right. The real short answer that I give people, especially experienced C-sharp developers, is that if you have a problem where you're really thinking that you want to use reflection and figure out something about a type and then see what capabilities it has and then invoke those capabilities. If you're starting to use the reflection APIs, maybe there's a much easier way just to treat that object as a dynamic object and let the DLR and the framework do the heavy lifting for you.
Okay.
In other areas, and then one of the samples that I put together that we can walk through a little bit today, is that there are a lot of capabilities where we want to have the data drive what happens in an object or in a type. And when we do it that way, then we can do things like load an XML file underneath an object. This is the sample I have. And then you can just use dot notation to get at the different underlying X elements or attributes there.
Mm. Okay. Mm-hmm. If you've got some of the code ready to go, we can maybe take a look at those samples, and then hopefully that will spur some questions. Oh, there's three in there now.
Oh, okay.
And William is asking one, and probably one we were going to get to a little later in the conversation, but we'll ask it anyway. What is the distinction between var and dynamic?
That's an excellent question.
Okay, actually, I'll start with looking at one of the samples, and that will right away show one of the that difference immediately. So
cool.
If we look at this sample here.
Yeah, go ahead and flip on your desktop share there.
Thank you very much for reminding me of that.
And we'll remind folks while it's coming up, you can press F5 to see Bill's desktop in full screen. But don't hide your question and answer panel too much because we want you to type questions too.
Okay, that should be coming up.
Yep.
Fairly quickly. Okay, so now what this small piece of code does is it creates a list of integers, and I'll talk immediately about word virus in just a sec, and then we're going to iterate those as though each item in the list was a double, okay, by using a link cast operator.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So let's start with looking at var. So what var says, and in fact, if I think IntelliSense will show up on live meeting, is if you look here, when I hover over var, it says this is class system.collections.generic.list of t, and that t is a system.in32. Now, that's because what var does is var tells the compiler that I don't really want to type the name again, so whatever this expression creates, that is the type of this variable, this list. So when I say new list event, that is the type of that list variable. And the same thing here, this answer one, if we look at this query expression, it's going to return an enumerable of double. In fact, if I look at var, that's exactly what it does. Okay, so the compiler knows what type it is, and if you were to look at this in Reflector, you would actually see answer one is typed as enumerable of double.
Okay.
And now I'm going to run this
query. The variable itself is still the type that you would have created if you had specifically said an enumerable, or in the case of list.
Right. That is correct. The variable is exactly the same. All that is really different here is you're typing fewer characters in most cases.
Okay.
So if I run this, we'll find out what happens is that this cast actually fails.
Oh.
And now I'm going to show a second example right down here that is very similar, but the cast down here is inside the query expression. So when I do the select, I say that to cast each item to a double. And that second one, if we look at the output again, that one works. And the reason it works is that generics are only able to look at the compile time type of the objects that they're working on.
Hmm.
Okay, so if you look at the top of this, you'll see that we're using this query expression, which in link actually turns into enumerable.cast. And that enumerable.cast looks somewhat similar to this method I've got down here called convert.
Mm-hmm.
That's we'll leave this in here and I'll explain what that does. And what convert does is it looks at each item in the sequence, and essentially what we're doing is we're just casting it to the output. And in the case of ints and doubles, a runtime cast is actually a conversion operator. It's going to convert the integer to a double. So it creates a different type. And the cast, only reference casts or boxing operations are allowed. Okay? And now if you look at what I've done here with convert, what I've said is take each item in the sequence, and we're going to assign this local variable to it that's actually a dynamic thing.
Hmm.
Okay, and we're telling the compiler at runtime you should figure out what capabilities this has.
Okay.
And then on the next line, I'm doing this yield return, which is added in the 3.0 frame or in the 2.0 version of C# to create an iterator method to say return this item in the sequence. And when you do that, by the way, cast it to the output type that I wanted. And now what's happened is because of this dynamic keyword, I've created this dynamic object, and I've told the compiler, produce whatever code you need to inspect this object at runtime and find out if there is some way, whether that be a conversion operator, a user-defined conversion, or a cast, or a boxing conversion, or whatever, to create this this particular transformation, this conversion. So now if I change this original link expression and remove this, and now if I can do it this way and then say dot convert.
Right, and you got that dot notation double there because it's an extension method.
That's correct. Okay. And now I'm taking each one and I'm converting it to a double using that convert operator rather than a cast operator. And if we go ahead and run this one now, we'll see that both conversions work. Because now...
And in your main code, you're just calling version 1 and then calling version 2, right?
Yeah, okay. We can take a look. I've just got a quick test harness here to run through the different bits of code that we have.
Excellent.
So then what's going on here now, this is one way to use dynamic, is that all I've done is I've taken what was a generic method, where in a generic method, all you can get at is all the compiler will assume is the methods and properties that are part of system.object unless you apply other constraints. Well, Now, by saying treat this as dynamic, I've told the compiler at runtime, whatever type happens to be here, you can do some work and figure out what it is, and then try to solve it based on that runtime information.
Mm.
Okay. The second big sample I'll go through, let me just comment these out so we're not running those and put this one in place, is that XML, you know, linked to XML, let me make this a little bigger. In linked to XML, you have a better API than we used to have, but there are times when I find that getting at different elements inside an XML element can still be rather painful. So
yeah.
What I have here is I've created, and I just do a quick return here so you can see what the data looks like. If we run this part, you're going to see that I've created an XML element that looks like all the planets and the moons in the solar system.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
Up to a point. Sorry, Pluto, you're gone. and what happens if we're trying to find different things in here, you can look at some of the XML expressions, like XML.element, we'll find the first planet. If I want to find Earth, I've got this look at planet, skip to
right.
it, and then find the first one. If I want to find the moons, it starts getting really crazy down here.
Oh, yeah.
Where we start getting XML.elements.planets, .first.moons, .whatever, right? That's pretty crazy stuff.
Yeah.
And what I want to do is I want to create a dynamic node that says, instead of trying to walk through all of these, what we're going to do is we're going to look at, create a dynamic object in C#, and it's going to look at the X element that I've loaded into the file, you know, from this file or from wherever, and it's going to let you apply dot notation to the elements. So what I want to do here is I can just do XML, dynamic XML.planet. So that's the first one.
Oh, wow.
I can say dynamic XML, and I can give it an indexer of planet 2. Of course, we're starting at 0, so that gives me the third planet. If I want to find one of the moon or the name of Earth, I can do it this way, just by adding the name element.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can do things like if I want to look for the moon, I can grab it using, once again, a combination of indexers and the moon node. Same thing here. I can make something work where one of the problems with the current XML API is if a node is missing, which is fairly common in XML files
right.
and such,
right.
if you try to just walk down the tree, you're going to end up with things that don't appear and they'll throw an exception. And I can fix that in my dynamic object by saying, well, you know, if Earth had three moons, this would, or four moons, this would return it. If it doesn't, when we run this, you'll see that this is going to return just the empty string.
Hmm.
So I can even do things like dynamic XML dot not appearing in this file. And that will just print out a blank string, or I can even chain things that don't appear together, so I can have dot notation all the way along and just keep returning empty stuff.
Now, clearly, since this is an evaluation at runtime, you're not going to get IntelliSense when you start hitting the dots.
That is correct. So if I want to look at something, and I'm typing in here, and I wanted to say dynamic XML, you know, my XML element, and I've got nothing. It's just dynamic expression. This will get resolved at runtime.
Right.
And that's one of the more interesting bits of the difference in dynamic programming. So we don't have IntelliSense, and in one sense that's important because it is a big productivity tool. In another sense, this is very much a very important aspect of what's different in dynamic and static typing.
Sure.
We have a lot of libraries and a lot of tooling that use reflection to see what's inside assemblies and to generate code for us, or to generate wrappers, or to create things around code that we already have,
mm-hmm.
and we'll do that by using reflection to look at the code that's there and then run with that code. You know, a lot of the editors to do bindings will use reflection to see what your business objects have so that it can give you a list of all the properties. Dynamic objects won't have that, so a lot of our tooling is not going to be there as well for dynamic objects.
Right.
And so
I think the other thing this feels a lot like is JavaScript.
Yeah, you could say that.
Yeah.
It certainly has that kind of an element. It's probably closer to something like Ruby or Python, where there's a little bit more typing in it.
Right.
But that type system is dynamic rather than kind of a weaker typing system like in JavaScript.
Right.
Sure.
So it sounds like, to kind of summarize this, if you're talking static typing versus dynamic typing. It sounds like the advantages of dynamic typing is that they can enable quicker development times, especially when it comes to things like this XML example you just showed. And then the other thing that you mentioned earlier, Bill, is the easier interoperability with dissimilar systems. I know you mentioned like Iron Ruby and Iron Python and also working with COM APIs and things like that. So those are kind of like the advantages of dynamic typing. And then static typing, we get IntelliSense. We have the compiler to cover our backs in case we make silly errors. One of the things that I think is also imperative with when you work with dynamic types is unit testing. Like, you should always unit test in my book, but when you move to dynamic types, it's not optional anymore. It's absolutely mandatory when you don't have a compiler, I think, covering you back. Does that kind of summarize kind of dynamic testing versus static?
And there's one other thing that I would add. First, I'd add one thing on the unit testing is it kind of changes how you have to do the unit testing. You know, there's things like in plain old C#, I probably wouldn't write unit tests around, say, an implicit property because I know that's going to work. I'm just writing tests that really don't help me with anything, right? Because the compiler generates all the code. I know if I have a get and set on some integer value or whatever, I'm confident that's going to work. In dynamic, I may want to have more tests around that because I want to make sure I spell the property correctly all the places I'm trying to use it. The other thing that I think is important is static typing is going to be faster than purely dynamic typing. It may not matter in a lot of cases because there's certainly been a lot of work in the DLR to make it as fast as possible, but the DLR is clearly doing more work than has to be done with a statically typed model. Okay, in static typing, the compiler's validated types, validated methods are there, properties are there, and that the types match. In dynamic typing, there's more work that has to be done at runtime, right, that the compiler may have already done for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Great point.
So this particular example, people can start using right away. I mean, they basically, I forget at the top of the file what you were doing to instantiate it, but it's
sure.
Dynamic XML.
So
this
is the second part of the kinds of things that you can do with dynamics. So what I've done here is dynamic XElement is derived from this dynamic object class.
Ah.
Dynamic object is part of the new 4.0 framework. Okay, and what dynamic object says is this is a type that I want to create as, and it will have dynamic properties. So there are overrides in dynamic object, and this one is try-get-member is the one I'm using, and try-get-index is the other one.
Mm-hmm.
And what those two members do is anytime you try to get a property, so if I scroll back up, if I go and look at here where I do where I said, this dot moon here. Okay, so that's trying to get a property named moon. And what will happen in the code is this try-get-member will get called, and I'm going to look for the value. Okay, so value is a special thing to give me just what's inside an element. And otherwise, I'm going to look for trying to find that element based on that name. And if I can find it, that's great. If I don't, well, then I'm going to return an empty element. So what I'm trying to do is look through the source and see if the element that you asked for with the dot notation existed. And if so, then I will return that element underneath it. Try get index does something similar where it's looking at the string, looking at the index, and we're going to look into the elements that are part of this dynamic element and then try to grab that element out and return it. So what's happening here on anything that uses dynamic, and I'll show a slightly simpler example to explain a little bit more of the concepts behind here, is that anytime some code calls a dynamic object, whether it be to access a field, access a property, work on operators, work on calling a method on it, any of those kinds of operations, this code will get invoked or one of these overrides to go, can you do this? Okay, and in the case of Iron Python or Iron Ruby objects, it will use a binder that's specific to the DLR. In the case of COM, there's a COM binder that will do COM introspection to see if a dynamic expression can be evaluated. And in the case of a C# created object that happens to be dynamic, it will look and see if it is derived from dynamic object. And dynamic object implements an interface called iDynamic Meta Object Provider, and that's actually the interface it looks for to see if an object can be treated as dynamic, or has dynamic capabilities. And we'll let you then, you know, basically parse all the method calls or all the property gets and sets or all the indexers to implement that behavior yourself as to what should actually happen.
Mm.
And as I said, since that one's a little bit on the complicated side, it is one of the items covered in the second edition of Effective C Sharp, so I walked through a lot of that code a little bit more closely. A simpler version of it is something that's a dynamic property bag. So we can create one of those, and what will happen is anytime I want to set some property, I'll call that try set member, and anytime I try to retrieve some property, like right down here, what will happen is I'll try to call try get member. And if you look at what happens here, what I'm going to do inside this dynamic property bag is I have a dictionary of string to object, and anytime I try to set it, I see if that property has already been set, and if so, I'll change its value, and if not, I will add one. And when
you're basically adding a property whenever the code says, here, let's give it a birthday property.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an upsert.
Exactly what it does. And then anytime we try to get a member, we see if it's something you've already done.
Okay.
If so, we'll go ahead and return that. And the way I've coded this one is if you ask for a property that isn't there, I'm just going to return a null. Okay, so
now, that's not a requirement, and that's basically your standard, and it's going to be the expectation on the consuming part of the code, right?
Right. You can set whatever semantics you want. You could throw an exception if a user tried to do something that wasn't already added to the dictionary. You could return some default value of missing. You could do whatever semantics you wanted on any of these.
Is there a typical convention? Because I'm anticipating, you know, one developer is going to create a dynamic property bag for something that some other developer is going to use. Would they just need to communicate between themselves, or is there sort of a standard convention?
Yeah, I haven't seen an actual standard for what happens if you can't do something.
Sure.
And I think it's probably a little early to define that. And I think there's definitely going to be reasons to want to do it in different ways, right? I mean,
sure.
You know, if I'm creating a property bag to pass to an MVC view, maybe I want, you know, I definitely don't want my pages to crash, so maybe I'll say just return the empty string if you can't find this, because then I'll return a page that exists but just doesn't have as much stuff. Or otherwise, you know, other conditions, maybe I do want to throw an exception, or maybe I want to take no action or what have you. So I think there's room to have different semantics in different ways there.
Okay.
It makes a lot of sense. I can see ways to apply this dynamic property bag. I mean, use this in your code when you don't know.
Right.
A lot of times you just don't know what you're going to get.
And one thing, this particular sample, what I would refer people to is there's a sample that's on part of the BCL or as an add-on on Code Gallery called the Expando object. And if you do a Bing search for Expando object in .NET, you'll find this. And it has a more full implementation than what I've shown here as an example. So it has a little bit more error checking and a little bit more capabilities, and that would definitely be the place I would look to add your own dynamic dictionary to your own code rather than to take this version, which was meant more to be illustrative than to be production code.
Got it. The Expando object.
Right.
Excellent. We can include a link to that
in the
show notes. Going back for a second, so one of the things, just to kind of close off on that var versus dynamic point, the example that you showed was really good. I think another core difference between them is when I have a var, I can set that var to, say, an integer, right?
Right.
But then if I took that same variable, say, let's call it I. So I have a var I equal 1.
Right.
And then if I then try to change it and say I equals, this is a string, or yeah, hello,
mm-hmm.
whatever, hello world, hello you, that would not work.
Right. And
however, with dynamics, that's no longer true, right? Could you write that code and kind of show that? Because
so,
I think that will help the person who asked
so
that question.
So as you see, when we just looked at that, if I leave that in there as you were typing, as you were speaking, that's a great explanation, Jennifer. You see the red squigglies there, and we've got the error that says cannot implicitly convert type string to int. And if instead if I change that to a dynamic, well, now that's just fine. It's going to be an integer here, so I could do something like, I could say var sum equals I plus 5. Okay, and that's going to be, there we go. And that's going to be absolutely fine, and that will work. Down here, now I is suddenly a string, so I can go I dot, or I space plus equals, you know, or geek speak audience. And that will work as well. And, of course, there's no compile time checking here. If I were to right here take this line and copy it up here, I believe that actually works because I think it will change I. I'm not sure. I'd have to run that to see what happens there. I think it might do a conversion there.
Are you talking about which line?
Right up here where I paste this up above.
Okay.
You know, that would compile just fine. I can do anything I want with right now with I as a dynamic. I can do something like I dot sum method. Well, that obviously at runtime is not going to work.
Yeah.
We're going to get an interesting exception there. But if I were to do sum dot sum method, I can type it, of course, but I'm pretty quickly going to get, that's interesting. Sum became a dynamic because that was
because,
dynamic.
Yeah, I think that's another important thing to call out. Your
what
actually happened there is he's taking a dynamic and adding something to a dynamic, and the result of
it's still a dynamic.
Yeah.
So this is dynamic at this point. Because what and that's a very good point with dynamic, and a very good bit of guidance as you're coding with these is that dynamic kind of leaks if you're not careful. So since I is dynamic here, then sum is now, as we see under our IntelliSense. Sorry, I got refactor there. So it now says that var this var sum is actually a dynamic object.
Interesting.
Right.
Now if I change this to var, so of course now my I is an int. We get our squigglies down here. Now if I look at sum, sum is now also going to be an int 32.
Yep. Yep. Good stuff. I think so doing operations with a dynamic variable tends, in most cases, not in all cases, but in most cases, the results will then be dynamic as well when the compiler has to figure it out.
Right. And sort of what happens there is at runtime, sum will actually be an integer, but the compiler thinks of it as dynamic, right? So the phrase that you'll often hear is that it is statically typed to be dynamic. Okay, so because I happens to be an integer, and when I add an integer to another integer, I happen to get an int, well, then that sum actually is an integer at runtime, but the compiler doesn't know anything about that.
Right.
Okay.
And if you're trying to,
kind of significant.
If you're trying to write expressions to examine the type of a variable or use reflection to go in, you basically have the same conclusion at that point because the IntelliSense is doing the same thing.
Right, right, right. If you were looking at reflection to see what was going on, you're going to get dynamic here.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to get a lot. You won't get information, so you'll essentially see system.object with some other meta tags on it. As to what's actually there. And, in fact, if you were to look at, the code for my that dynamic property bag or the expander object, or if you were to look at the code containing that dynamic XML element, and if you were to look at those with reflection, you wouldn't find any of the properties that are available at runtime because those are all dynamic properties. They aren't really there for the reflection APIs.
Right. Right.
And then I think you've illustrated a couple of examples of doing conversions back and forth between dynamic. It looks like it's very easy to convert to dynamic and then back to int. You can basically, so I have this dynamic I right now, which is basically an int.
Right.
I could just create an int j and set it equal to I, and that would do the conversion back.
Now let's actually remove these here because they're doing something slightly different.
Yeah.
And if I were to do that, yes, that's going to do exactly what you think it will. And what will happen is because I is dynamic, the compiler essentially generates code to go, well, this is a dynamic object. Does it have some way to represent itself as something that can be converted to an integer?
Okay.
So
and then it figures that out at runtime.
That's correct.
Excellent.
Are there any considerations for dynamics as arguments to a method call?
Yeah, actually, and that's one of the other use cases that I find very useful with dynamic at different times. One thing that's very hard in the C-sharp 3 land is to write methods that operate on anonymous types.
Yeah.
Right? Because anonymous types don't have names.
Oh, right, all right. You can't, you can't put the type there in the
right.
You can't even put var, I guess, in the method
signature. Right. So I could do something like I can say var an item equals new, and we'll just give it a property of date equals date time dot now, message equals hello, right? So this is an anonymous type that's got just a, sorry, probably not, not including that. Okay, so now we've got that in place. And now if I wanted to write a method that printed the information for something that had a date and a message, I could write a method, private static, print a record, and we'll say that's going to take a dynamic item, and I can have just format that to look like saying something like console.WriteLine. And if you notice here, okay, so we'll just do, let's say, date equals bang zero, and message equals bang one. And then, of course, if I now take my item, let me just move the IntelliSense a little bit, so item, and if I hit the dot, you see I don't get anything.
Mm.
I have to remember what properties I put in place. And that's, let me put a carriage return here so we can see a little bit more of the code. And I forgot void up there, of course, but now we've got this method that acts on any anonymous type that happens to have those two fields in it. So if we go ahead and just run this, you'll see that it, I thought I had that in there. Yeah, let's actually call that method.
We didn't call the method in main, yep.
Yep. Print record with that item. And there, of course, now it's going to throw that out. And I can create something, and I can, it doesn't have to be the same type. I can do item two is new, and one of the joys of working with this is you can even put different types in place here. And give it a message, key code of 123. And if we print that one, because it's dynamic, that will work as well. Because once again, I have a property named date. It knows how to print that out. And I have a property named message.
Sure.
And the compiler knows that those are around. So perfectly happy to go ahead and write different things there.
Yeah, as long as you can start doing any kind of custom type methods at the end of those things.
Well,
like dealing with date or trying to resolve it and trying to get the month name out of it or something.
Right, right. If you had to, if you tried to do something that did a little bit more work with those and made more assumptions about what those properties were, yes, that's correct. And you could get into a lot of trouble and it would start to fail quickly. But, you know, if you're thinking of it, something being dynamic and it may have different types underneath it, you know, you have to code a little bit differently to make use of that. But that's definitely one of the things that I do that mixes var and dynamic, where I can write methods on these anonymous types. It's actually quite useful in link expressions, you know, where you return projections from a database and you have some of the fields in play, but not all of them, and you want to do different bits of work with those. I found that very useful.
How about the best scenarios to use this, or maybe the most common ones? Do you see people writing their own dynamic classes with the try, gets, and all those things, and this type of thing where you have a dynamic as an argument, and then sharing with an external developer, or do you see them more being used in the same sort of client and server, bad analogy, but you know what I mean?
Sure. In the same application.
Yeah, in the same application or the same code that they write, or is this more for people to write to make it more consumable from other developers?
Okay, so I actually think the most common use cases for dynamic is more consuming things and telling the compiler to treat something as dynamic.
Okay.
You know, something like this example that we just looked at. The examples earlier where I was coercing something to be dynamic to avoid making a lot of reflection calls, right, to be able to exercise types at runtime rather than, without necessarily knowing everything at compile time.
Sure.
And I think that's actually going to be more useful and more common. Also, interacting with DLR languages or COM. When you're creating your own dynamic objects, I think that they're going to be more those kinds of objects that are heavily data-driven and are probably part of lower libraries that will be used in other applications. Because I think, and once again, this is still kind of early in the game, but I think that for dynamic programming inside a single application, if you have a small scope gap and you already know all the types, it might be simpler just to write a specific type with the specific properties you need and stay statically typed throughout the whole operation.
Right.
Whereas, if you're creating some base functionality that you expect a lot of developers to use, well, in those cases, you're probably going to want to look at doing more dynamic typing and try to share it that way to get more broad use of the classes that you're writing.
Right, it increases their flexibility.
Right, right.
Are there any other considerations for using this with Link or with the Entity Framework specifically or, other aspects of code or maybe even other languages? Could you create a dynamic type and then consume that from, let's say, Visual Basic?
Yeah, you absolutely could. The dynamic keyword, I think the syntax is a little different in VB, and to be honest, I'm not that good on all the syntax in VB. But yes, VB does support dynamic objects. VB can also create dynamic objects derived from this same dynamic object as well, and they can be consumed in C#. I believe F# has support, but I'm not absolutely certain of that. And clearly we can create C# objects and make them dynamic objects and consume them in Iron Ruby or Iron Python, just like we could statically type C# objects. And in the same way, C# can consume those dynamic objects from those DLR languages. I think what's different there is that if you're writing in Ruby or Python where everything is dynamic, you're going to tend to have this dynamic typing all over the place. Whereas in C# or VB, I think that the more common case is going to be to try to use static typing as much as possible and have these little pockets of scope where something is dynamic and then move back to that comfort of static typing as quickly in scope as you can rather than have dynamic types flow through the entire program.
Right.
I think if your design calls for that, you're probably better off looking at a real dynamic language rather than coercing C# to do that.
Yeah. Imperious Leader from the Q&A mentioned that this also helps with COM interop as well.
Yes. Right, and especially with those items that are iDispatch or with some of the Office APIs that have a lot of default. Well, we also have default and optional parameters now. But yes, definitely with iDispatch type APIs, that's going to be a huge help.
Absolutely, with all the variants.
Right, right.
Yes. Very good stuff.
Is there a particular type of application where you see this being used a lot, maybe ASP.NET versus WPF app versus maybe a Windows Phone 7 app, or pretty much it doesn't matter the scenario?
I think it doesn't really matter. Now, if you'd have asked me about a month ago, I would have guessed that ASP.NET and especially ASP.NET MVC would be probably one of the most common uses for this kind of dynamic programming, just because of the model there. And the architecture of that system, I thought that was going to be probably one of the most common ones. But another individual that works in our office named Brian Geneseo has built an MVVM set of classes for WPF that support, that use dynamic types as the view model so that you can just add new properties to the view model, which is really an interesting use case that I had not thought of,
wow.
And that's really quite powerful.
Good deal. And Brian was utilizing Prism as well for that.
Yes, yes.
Very cool. Very cool.
Do you have any other samples of dynamic keywords?
You know, those are the biggest ones that we put together. We kind of talked around a couple of the others.
Good deal. Let me remind everyone that you can go ahead and submit questions through the Q&A manager. Just click on Q&A at the top of the panel, and then feel free to submit questions if you do have other things to ask. But I like everything that you've shown here, Bill. The difference between VAR and Dynamic was good, all the conversion stuff, and then just a lot of the things you've shown how to interact and use Dynamic as part of the as a parameter when you're setting as parameter, kind of the special considerations there. Mm-hmm. A lot of very, very cool stuff there. And then just the advantages in working with XML, that's huge. Just, I mean, who hasn't had to parse XML at one point in their career, right?
So I think, you know, as we're getting sort of toward the end of the hour, unless there's other questions that come in.
Yeah, well, we do have one from Andre. He was basically wanting some insight into some of the challenges that the team found when they were trying to make C-sharp dynamic. And that may also be a good opportunity for you to lend some perspective, Bill. I don't know if you worked with the language team when they were implementing the dynamic keyword, but if you did, maybe there's some insight you could share with.
Okay, so as an MVP, we certainly get some previews on some of the ideas behind the design. And probably the best resource for that right now, which we'll have to look up and add to the show notes, is in the 2009 PDC. Mads Torgersen gave a talk on the design behind dynamic, where he talked about not only, you know, the design they ended up using with the dynamic keyword, but also about some of the designs that they talked about before then that they ended up rejecting. One of the early ones was to actually have a dynamic scope, which would have looked something like, they were going to say dynamic, if I remember right, and then open bracket, and
bracket,
then, you know, a whole lot of code in here, and then close, and now suddenly we're back to static.
Mm.
They rejected that, and Mads gives probably the best explanation there in terms of why they did that and why they went with this dynamic type instead. And I do think it ends up being a better decision. I think it's easier to make dynamic typing flow with a variable rather than have everything dynamic inside a scope. So then to get to kind of the guidance on it, so what I like to do is think of the fact that, in general, I'll try just doing everything in static typing in C#. Because, you know, we still believe, at least in the C# community, that static typing has a lot of advantages. You know, and I think Eric Meyer has the quote, static typing when you can, dynamic when you must. So we'll start by trying to say, let's do everything we can with static typing.
Sure.
And now, keys that make me think I should be doing something using dynamic typing instead is, if I find myself doing reflection to try to get members and find methods that I'm going to invoke, that's probably a pretty good key that I should change that variable to a dynamic object and let the DLR and the framework do the heavy lifting to find the methods and properties that I want to invoke instead of using reflection to go through and see what's there. So I find that's probably the first key. The second key is, if you look at the first example that I showed here, the meta idea behind this is, if you look at generics in general, are very, very strong when there's compile type information that the compiler knows about for whatever your type parameters are. You know, in this case, it would be this T out. Okay, but if you're trying to write a generic method or a generic class that needs to know something at runtime, well, the compiler really can't help there because it doesn't know about it. And that's when you're going to have to make this thing dynamic for a little bit. And then if you don't, once again, the guidance here is, the scope of this dynamic variable is this far.
Right.
At that point, it's dynamic. And as soon as I have this cast operation, it's back to static typing again. Right. It's returned as a T out, not as a dynamic.
That's, yeah, it's important there, based on, I think, what we saw with our integers, to actually do that casting.
Right. So we're trying to minimize that dynamic scope as much as possible and yet leverage that capability as much as we possibly can.
Got it.
To do that. Now, and then the third kind of why we're doing a lot of dynamic things when we create it is, just about every time I've created a dynamic object, it has to do with something that I really want a very data-driven object. So some data input is going to change the behavior of this object. You know, whether that be this dynamic XML element that changes the properties that it has and the indexers that it has based on the data file you feed it, you know, or this dynamic dictionary that's somewhat like the Expando object whose properties change based on the data that you give it. And I have to say that every dynamic object I've written in practice is like that, where it's really highly data-driven in terms of what it does.
Yeah, you mentioned being close to the data there and using that sort of as a decision point. Where does dynamic keyword come into play if you're doing data binding to controls in the UI? Is there any?
Okay, now, as I understand it now, and this is one that I might be a little fuzzy on, WPF and Silverlight will work with dynamic objects for data binding. And I believe, well, with ASP.NET MVC, I believe it works as well. And however, I believe that with WebForms and WinForms, dynamic objects don't participate in data binding because of the way those APIs were written. I would have to verify that, and we can add that to the show notes later,
okay.
But that's my understanding at this time.
One other thing I think you mentioned in your book, Bill, around when you're talking about dynamic programming in C-sharp is the expression API.
Right.
And a little bit more about now that, you know, C-sharp has link and these dynamics, this dynamic support, rather than using, you know, classic reflection APIs, you have the ability to do some of this expression trees and expressions as well. Do you have any, want to make any comments on that?
Yeah, so that's a slightly different flavor of dynamic programming. And what we can do there, and I don't have a sample keyed up, and they usually take a little bit longer to type, so I'm not going to dive into one.
Oh, yeah, no,
but the general idea there is that any place where we had something like a, well, I can probably do something real quick to maybe give a glimpse of it. We don't need this anymore. But we can do something like if we were to make, let's think of a quick example. If I were to make a func of int, let me just take it, let's see, increment, and we'll take an int I, and we'll just return I plus 1. Okay, so that's a pretty simple lambda expression. Okay,
yep.
And I probably typed something wrong here. Does not take one argument. Okay, so I need func of int, comma int. There we go. Okay, so now I've got a function that takes an integer and returns an integer. Okay, well, what we can do in C-sharp and is I can actually make this an expression of a func of int. Okay, and now we have something slightly different. We need to resolve this. So that's in system.link.expressions. And now we've got an expression, okay? So let's just do something slightly different so you can see the difference. If I do this this way as a func, and this one is an expression. And now if I can call increment func, oops, I can give it 5, and that's going to return, we're pretty sure that's going to return 6, okay? That doesn't quite work with the increment expression, okay? If I want to work with the increment expression, I don't have just this call syntax. You see, that doesn't quite work, actually. Okay, need a different variable there because we just really don't know what that is. However, what we can do is I can take it and compile it, and then we can invoke it.
Wow.
Okay, so what we have with this increment expression is rather than being an actual delegate, what we have is a data structure that defines what that code would be.
Okay.
Now, where that's used in practice is in linked to SQL or entity framework when you create a query expression that's stored as an expression, and then the library looks at that expression and says, oh, I know how to translate that into SQL.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the SQL that gets executed. You know, in my case right here, I looked at that expression and I said I want to compile it into IL, and then we're going to execute it. Other things we could do with this that we can, let's just leave this, let's just
That's very powerful. So you have the ability to build up your own expressions.
Well, we can also look at it.
And execute.
I can do. So we can look at it. Let's actually probably walk through this in the debugger, and I'll see if I can make that window big enough. But if we go down and if we get to here now, if we look at what this expression is.
Oh, there's the body. Yeah, yeah.
There's a whole lot of stuff in here. I don't know, Jennifer, do you know a quick way to make the compiler or the this window a font a little bit bigger?
Unfortunately, there's not really a quick way to do it. Yeah,
okay.
I'm sorry.
So what we can see is if we look at the body, you can see that what we've got is my left expression is this. We can see that it's an its name is I, it's a parameter, its type is an integer. Okay. And if we look at the right side of the body, we can see that, you know, its type, I have to blow it pretty big. We can see that it's got one, it's a constant, it is an integer. And if we look at the expression itself, other than this body, we can see its parameters, it's got one of them.
Mm-hmm.
The return type we can see is also an integer. We can see its type, because it's going to have a func name and it's going to have some values in it. So its type is, this increment expression is has that lambda. Its type is a lambda expression. And this is what's involved. So you can walk through an expression or an expression tree, and you can see all the things that go into the expression. Okay, so when we pass an expression into some other bit of code, rather than just executing it, you can look at it, examine it, and see what's actually there. Other things you can do with the expression API is we can do, this I'll probably get wrong because I haven't quite practiced it, and it takes a little bit of time if you're going to build one up, but I can do expression dot, if I could make an add expression, and now I can give it an expression dot constant, and I'm going to give it 5. And then if I were to take another expression, dot constant, you know, and another, say, another 5, okay? And now that expression is going to be now an add expression of adding 5 and 5. Okay, so, and you can build these up under whatever operations you want to build code at runtime using the expression APIs, you know, rather than reflection dot emit or something like that. So this is a different form of dynamic programming. Comes into play a little bit less often, but there are certainly a few cases where it's pretty useful to build up code at runtime and then go ahead and execute that code.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks.
Very cool. A lot of useful scenarios, Bill, so that's pretty nice.
It is a lot of fun. I really like the direction that they took and the kinds of things we can now really make this a very powerful language for a lot of different kinds of problems.
Absolutely. Well, we went and flew right through that hour with our conversations and demos, so I've gone ahead and advanced everybody on the slide deck to our sort of a wrap-up slide. We've got links here to our GeekSpeak blog. You can see upcoming GeekSpeaks. We'll be introducing our series again in July of this year. And you can also catch the recordings of our past shows on Channel 9. That link is here as well. I've got my blog and Jennifer's blog linked here, and Bill, yours is linked here as well on srtsolutions.com.
Okay.
And any last words, any last advice to folks in general to where they can get started with the dynamic keyword and other dynamic programming aspects?
Well, certainly my book, More Effective, Effective C-Sharp, second edition, is a good one.
Okay.
I actually think John Skeet has a fantastic resource in C-Sharp in depth. That's coming out, and Michael Michaelis's book, Essential C-Sharp 4.0, is another very good resource for that. You'll find some things in the C-Sharp Dev Center. If you go to just C#.net, that's a very good resource to find a lot of things on the language in general, and certainly dynamic and dynamic metaprogramming are two of the bigger topics that are getting more and more coverage these days.
Mm-hmm.
And those would certainly be some of the best places to look.
Awesome. Well, Bill, thanks so much for coming on and sharing with us your knowledge this hour. Definitely appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me.
Jennifer, thanks for co-hosting.
No problem.
Okay, and we will turn it over to our webcast producer to do some final wrap-up. We do have a survey coming up, so we hope everybody fills that out. Thanks for signing on for this Geek Speak.